Today's Friday, October 18th, and we're having Dmitry Orlov with us to talk about the conflicts in the Middle East and in Ukraine. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Good to be with you.
Let's get started with the latest news that Yahya Sinwar was killed by Israelis. And how is it going to change the situation in Gaza?
It won't. people seem to think that political assassination will somehow change the course of events. All that political assassination does is drive the cycle of revenge, of blood revenge, to a higher level than before. So every time the Israelis kill one of these figureheads, and that's what they are, anybody that you actually see that you can identify, that the Israelis know exists, you can be sure that that person does not make operational decisions. That's just a political figurehead. So all that does is make people mad and help the recruiting efforts of the organization in question, be it Hamas or Hezbollah. And so the Israelis are too stupid to realize that they're basically thwarting their own purpose. They're hurting their own cause by resorting to terrorism, to political assassination. It makes them feel good, I guess, to be able to do this. But we've seen this already with Hamas and with Hezbollah, that political assassination does not work.
In it seems that before this latest news that the Biden administration, Biden said that we were cooperating with them, we were giving the information to Israelis to find Yahya Sinwar and assassinate him. And in your opinion, we had the same attitude in the Trump administration, if you remember, with the assassination of General Soleimani in Iraq. And right now, the Biden administration seems to have the same kind of policy. And if we go beyond that Netanyahu administration, the people who are in Washington, do they really believe that they're helping Israel by this?
Well, I don't think that there's actually any kind of a conscious decision-making process behind it. It's just they have operatives, and these operatives earn their stripes by doing this kind of work, by figuring out who's nominally in charge, by looking at leaders. They are trained to go and look at leaders, identify where they are. Identify where they're going to be, find weak spots in their security, and then feed that information to whoever wants it, or whoever wants to go and assassinate them. And that's the sort of thing that they do. There's no stopping them, and they don't have any sort of a process in place to reflect on whether this is doing any good or whether it's actually hurting them. Now, with General Soleimani, they actually accidentally, I suppose, hit a jackpot because he was an important figure. He was actually behind a great deal of organization that went on within Iran to strengthen Iran organizationally, and he was a great man. You know, he was generally recognized. He had stature, not just within Iran, but within the region. So that was actually something that they did that could have potentially hurt Iranians, except, you know, as usual, the horse was out of the barn. Soleimani has already done his work, and that work persists to this day in terms of the organizational capacities of the Iranians. His death really hasn't hurt it in any appreciable way. But say that the death of Soleimani did something or could have potentially done something productive from the point of view of the Americans, although I seriously doubt it. And I would say, on the other hand, the Iranian side, where they hit some American military base in Iraq, and the Americans just sat there because they couldn't do anything in response. You know, that just showed up how vulnerable the American presence is in the region. And in fact, now they're finally, the democracy, the bureaucracy is very slow, and they're finally scuttling their mission in Iraq now. So overall, I think that basically it's sleepwalking into disaster. It's not any sort of reasoned policy that leads to these political assassinations.
Yeah. We had, Dmitry, recently, 2 days ago, we had this Israeli attack on Al-Aqsa Hospital, in which people were burning alive. Do you think that the international community is just doesn't care anymore, what considering what's going on in Gaza? Because the way that they're attacking these people who have nothing to defend themselves from these attacks, how we can understand, how can we understand the behavior of international community? And it doesn't seem that anybody is willing to help them.
Well, I think that there are two elements to this. One is that the international community is just words. It does not exist. There is no such thing as an international community. People keep using those words thinking that they mean something. They don't mean anything. There is no international community. Second, made in that direction, I don't know to what extent they will succeed. But this is all genocide, and this is all being conducted by genocide happy people, Israelis, Americans, Europeans, whoever they may be.
And how about right now, what's your take on what's going on in Lebanon? They have assassinated the same kind of policy. They have assassinated the Hezbollah's leader, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, together with his commanders. And right now, how do you see the fight that is going on in the southern part of Lebanon between Israelis and Lebanese?
There's no fight. The Israelis cannot penetrate. All they can do is blow up things full of people in various places. they can't achieve any military objectives whatsoever, because destruction of civilians is not a military objective. That is not a valid target. So all they can do is waste resources on killing people. Again, murder of civilians is not something that you can count as a military aim. Now, in terms of securing southern Lebanon, they've been able to penetrate at most 1 kilometer into a Lebanese territory before they get stuck. They've lost something like 50 people as casualties and about a tenth of those wounded. And out of action completely. They're losing people. There's no sign that Hezbollah has been weakened at all by political assassinations, as one would expect. They have a network-based power structure, and they're separated into small groups, each with its own sector and with its own base of operations and set of prerogatives, set of aims. So there's no reason to believe that politically beheading the organization as many times as you care to do it is going to do anything except recruit more people to the cause, because now there's more reasons for revenge. Now, the important thing that happened that shouldn't be ignored is that Israel has become defenseless. The Iron Dome is like a cauldron. You can flip it over and use it to drain spaghetti. It's not useful for stopping rocket attacks anymore. They're out of they're out of those rockets, the anti-air missiles. Most of those are imported from the United States, and the United States can't make them fast enough. So the Iron Dome is dead, and Iran and Hezbollah to some extent have a more or less infinite supply of rockets to shoot at Israel, which they've been doing. They've been hitting pretty much any point in Israel that they care to hit. And, you know, that will wear down Israel over a period of time. It will wear down the economy. It will cause the population to dwindle. And it will, in general, demoralize the Israeli fighting force to a point where it won't be able to do much of anything at all. There are signs of absolute desperation on the Israeli side, such as they're recruiting Orthodox Jews who are pacifists into the military, which is just a ridiculous thing to do if you know what those people are. So they're resorting to absolutely ridiculous moves in order to shore up their military, which is not achieving any of its objectives, not in Gaza, not in Lebanon. So Israel is really just circling the drain as far as I can tell.
And they're insisting to attack Iran. And it seems that the Biden, Washington was able to convince them, it seems, to not to attack the nuclear and oil facilities in Iran. And when right now do you think that they're going to go after some sort of assassinations, or they're going to attack Iran by their fighter jets, missiles, and a conventional type of war?
Well, as far as I can tell, Israelis have only air-launched capacity. So they have to launch those rockets from somewhere close to Iran. It's quite a distance, you know. They can't fly over Saudi Arabia. I don't know if they can fly over Turkey. They can't fly over Iraq. So what does that leave? Nothing. Nothing. Plus, they can't fly that far without midair refueling. How are they going to hit Iran? I have no idea. Secondly, you said that the Americans somehow talk down the Israelis. The Israelis don't listen to Americans. What happened is that the Russians said that if Israel attacks nuclear facilities in Iran, then Russia would have to interfere. And there may be some feedback loop going through the Pentagon, basically saying, Israel, if you do this, then we'll just basically let the Russians deal with you. You're no longer our ally, because at that point you will have done the unspeakable, which is nuclear terrorism. And so maybe that reflected somehow on the Israelis. But I think what reflects on the Israelis, what influences the Israelis the most, in fact, is operational impotence at this point.
But in your opinion, who's running the show? We have a discussion here on this podcast. Who's running the show about who's running the show in the Middle East in terms of the policies that have been implemented in the Middle East? In your opinion, is that the Israeli lobby, is the government, the Netanyahu administration and his party, or the neocons together with the Israeli lobby?
Well, it's chaos. There are no policies. It's just people doing things on a daily basis that make them somehow feel like they're achieving something or doing something. But none of it is particularly productive in any way. There is a defensive wall that now exists, consisting of Russia and Iran working together. There are very good diplomatic relations between both Russia and Iran and Middle Eastern states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. The Kuwaiti representatives were just in Moscow, United Arab Emirates. They're all pretty much on board with this plan of quashing aggression, military aggression. There's Israel, which is basically a voice, you know, out crying in the wilderness at this point. Nobody particularly listens to them because they've squandered their diplomatic potential completely. They're untouchable at this point. Yes, there's an Israeli lobby, but what does it lobby now? Because Washington is in such disarray. Nobody's going to be on record now making plans because nobody knows what's going to happen next. Maybe Trump will get shot next week. Maybe Kamala Harris will suffer an aneurysm from laughing too hard. Nobody knows what's going to happen in Washington. So there's the problem of not being anything in particular to lobby. I think the only voice of sanity in Washington now is the Pentagon, which absolutely knows for sure that it doesn't want a war with Russia. So there's really very little else going on other than the Pentagon people periodically stopping in and slapping down the White House people when they get too active in their attempts to try to show that they're still useful in some way.
Do you feel that the Pentagon is in charge in the Middle East as well?
Nobody is in charge in the Middle East. It's chaos. You cannot control chaos by claiming to be in charge. How can the Pentagon be in charge when it has lots of defenseless military bases that anybody can attack at will? If tomorrow the Houthis decide to blow up some American air base in the region, they'll just go ahead and do it. If the Houthis decide to sink an aircraft carrier, they could probably arrange that as well. So what can the United States do to project force? This is all about force projection and imposing discipline. They can't impose discipline. They've already shown that they can't impose discipline on the Israelis, and they're supposed to be the closest allies. So the United States no longer has any friends in the region at all. None. Israel is supposed to be a friend, but with friends like that, you don't need enemies. So, it's just chaos, and the United States is kind of out of the game.
And as you mentioned, the point that you brought up right now, I think it's so crucial for the United States foreign policy in the Middle East. And are these people incapable of controlling Israel, or they don't care what's going on in the Middle East as long as they're having Israel in that region?
Well, I don't think anybody can control Israel, and that's very unfortunate. I think Israel is too far gone politically. No amount of demonstration in the streets of Tel Aviv are going to change the picture at all. It's basically a bunch of criminals who know that they are going to jail the moment they're out of power. So they will do whatever they have to stay in power through whatever means. Including terrorism, including political assassination, including sacrificing their own troops for no apparent reason. They will do all of that, and telling them not to do something and instead relinquish power and go to jail, well, that's not very useful from the American point of view.
And how about the Israeli economy right now? Does it have the strength to sustain this type of wars, conflicts in the Middle East right now? They are in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, they're trying to do something. And against Houthis, Iran, Iraq, and all of these countries. And at the same time, they're having a lot of difficulties with Arab states, with Turkey right now. Erdogan is getting much more serious, it seems, at least what he talks about. And how about their economy right now? Do they care about their economy? Is that sustainable for them to keep up with these fights in the region?
Well, I mean, they're willing to wreck their economy provided they get to stay out of jail. criminals, don't talk about people around them being prosperous and happy. That's not what criminals do. In terms of how much it's costing, the absolute base cost is around $10,000 a year per Israeli citizen. That's just basically munitions cost, armor, and probably doesn't even include all of the personnel costs. Then on top of that, you probably have another $10,000 per person of opportunity costs, because all of these people are in the military instead of doing their job. Then there are various other losses having to do with tourism being zeroed out, which is something like 3 or 4% of the Israeli economy. Now it's zero. There are probably costs associated with the difficulty of getting imports in because of the Red Sea being shut down. Then there is all the stuff that's basically has to do with relocating people, with people not being able to live and be productive where they're supposed to be. The entire territory up north next to the Lebanese border, you know, is now free of people who have become internally displaced people, refugees. If you add all of that up, it turns out that the cost of the war is quite a bit larger than the average income of the Israeli. So you essentially just zeroed out Israeli incomes on average. Now, that's probably not a very advanced, statistically advanced way of analyzing it, but what it tells you is that this cannot go for another year or two. Israel will be just completely broke, devastated. Oh, I also forgot to mention the fact that the smartest people are all living. All of the people who have, you know, the means and the multiple, the foreign passports and or the means to live abroad, they're all kind of quietly filtering out. They're going to Cyprus. They're going to Greece. They're going to other places in Europe, some of the states. So Israel is losing the most productive part of the population. They no longer want to stay in a war zone. And so that will kind of thin out Israel in terms of the amount of people who stay and are capable of doing anything at all, are capable of even defending themselves. So that doesn't bode well for Israel, I'm afraid.
Yeah. In terms of the situation that we're having in the Middle East, we know that the United States is not going to do anything substantially to change the situation. We have to think of other superpowers like China, Russia, and regional powers like Iran and Turkey, who are not happy with the situation. Do you think that are we going to get to the point that at the end of the day, these countries, China, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, are working with each other to put an end to this conflict in the Middle East?
Well, why would they put an end to this conflict? I mean, you have to find some rational answer why they would want to waste resources on ending this conflict. Are they happy about the existence of Israel, any of them? Are they ecstatic that the state of Israel exists? Or would they be equally happy to see it go away? What would they have to do to make it eventually go away? Anything at all? If they can just sit with their arms folded and Israel will eventually go away, isn't that the happiest scheme they could possibly think of? Just do nothing, and what you want to see happen happens eventually. No rush. I think that they're pretty well convinced that Israel can't really do any serious damage to anyone at this point. On the other hand, Israel can suffer very serious damage if it steps over certain lines, such as hitting nuclear installation in Iran, for instance. That's the point at where somebody might get involved, where the Russians might actually look up from very important things that they're doing that have nothing to do with Israel, notice that Israel exists, being a tiny little place, and decide to do something about it, such as make sure that it can't do any of those strikes by possibly feeding some information or some weapons to Iran. I'm not sure what the military means, the kinetic means of achieving that goal might be, but I'm sure that the Russians have lots of abilities to do that. So Israel is pretty well hemmed in, and I don't think anybody particularly wants to waste the lives of their own soldiers in doing anything about Israel, seeing as it's taking such good care of itself and is slated to disappear in a not too distant future. The only thing that I see going on that is sort of hopeful is there is some background discussion on who should be the keepers of the Holy Land once Israel is gone. So there is the understanding, and of all places from Poland, that there should be a kind of an interfaith consortium consisting of Muslims, Catholics, Orthodox, various other churches that should be the keepers of Jerusalem, of the sacred shrines, once Israel is gone. And that's a productive discussion. You know, the Holy Land has been the Holy Land for 2,000 years. It'll be the Holy Land for 10,000 more. So over that period of time, there have been long periods of time under the Ottomans, for instance, when all of these faiths had equal access to Jerusalem. And so that should remain that way, no matter who runs Palestine, or whether there is an entity politically called Palestine or an entity called Israel or not.
And in terms of what's going on in the southern part of Lebanon, we had multiple attacks on UNIFIL, and which is part of the UN. And we know that the Israel's existence is based on a decision made by UN. And right now they're attacking UN. And how is that make sense in your opinion?
Well, I think the UN is pretty much done. If you look at how it votes, anytime the vast majority of the world decides to sanction Israel, there are a few nations that vote against that resolution. Those nations being the United States, which is sort of owned by the Israeli lobby, at least in terms of the UN vote, Israel itself, and then a bunch of island nations, Micronesia, Tuvalu, and a few others, whose representatives will vote the way you want if you stuff a $100 bill in their shirt pocket on the way to the meeting. They're tiny nations that don't matter. So basically, you have the United States and Israel on one side, and everybody else who isn't bribed to vote a certain way on the other. And what does that say about the adequacy or the usefulness of the UN as an institution? Well, there are a couple of rogue states in it that should be expelled. And since there's no mechanism of doing that, let's abandon the UN and start working on other forms of organization that exclude these rogue states, such as SCO, such as BRICS, etc. And that's what the world is actually doing. Plus, you know, the UN is its headquarters in the wrong country. It's headquarters on the territory of a rogue state. And that rogue state sometimes grants visas to diplomats and correspondents, journalists, and sometimes it doesn't. And so that's what it's obligated to do. It doesn't live up to its obligations, so it can't really be the host of the United Nations anymore. Again, there is no way to change that. So the UN is pretty much useless, and the world is moving on.
Is that possible BRICS replacing UN in the future?
No, it won't replace it. I don't know what the right word is, but it's not a drop-in replacement by any means. The UN is this kind of big tent, happy to admit everybody, even if they're just not very useful in an international capacity. I think that in the future, the world will be organized along far more reasonable lines, so that there are some big nations that control a lot, and there are some tiny nations that control nothing. So why should they have the same ability to vote? Nobody can answer that question.
Where are we heading with this new summit, BRICS summit in Kazan?
We'll have to wait and see. It hasn't happened yet. Various sides have made various announcements. Clearly, an exchange mechanism will be discussed, but I'm waiting to see what details will emerge. Russia has decided to open the floodgates in some controlled manner for crypto. Also, everybody seems to be on board with the idea of using blockchain. The idea of using central banks as opposed to some privately owned but sovereign-controlled clearinghouses for international exchange, that seems to be gaining favor. I know what the ideal scheme is some kind of like a wormhole linking central banks of various countries, where money in one currency goes into your local central bank and comes out on the other side. And in the process, money is created and destroyed as needed to make the ledgers balance out, and without causing these central banks to issue currency that isn't supported by the trade that's taking place. That would be a beautiful scheme. And given that there's currently technology that wouldn't be much more expensive than the technology that central banks are already using, exchange mechanism could be almost entirely frictionless. There is also some talk of making a pricing mechanism that is independent of the US dollar or the euro, because if you have lots of countries participating in international trade, they have to have some common benchmark for establishing prices. So there's this unit proposal that has been circulated around, and I don't know how much favor it has gained. So what we really have to watch for is how many BRICS members and how many aspiring BRICS members, because there are lots of them, would favor this or that plan, at what rate they would accept it. I'm sure that there's going to be more bilateral cooperation along these lines. You know, Russia and China are trading in their own currencies already. Russia and India are making strides in that direction. I only know what Russia does. Russia and Iran are talking about similar things. So going from bilateral to trilateral to multilateral is a process that could potentially take place that would be a lot less tricky than rolling out some universal system to everybody at once. I hope that people take that direction as opposed to doing something very, very ambitious and risky. But we'll have to wait and see. It's an important meeting. What you already know in terms of what people are feeling and saying is that nobody really wants to invest in the US dollar or the euro. It's not just Russia that considers them toxic. There are lots of other people who have come around to that realization as well. So there needs to be some kind of replacement. So we'll have to see what that is.
Trump is talking about 100% tariffs on the countries who are not willing to use the US dollar for their trades. Is that possible to reverse the situation in the future if he wins in the United States to convince the countries to use the US dollar?
Well, no, that's just a tax on the American consumer. That's all it is. It'll cause more inflation in the US. Everybody else will just look the other way. Like, look, the Americans are doing something stupid again, whatever. If Trump thinks that this is how you convince people to be your friends and cooperate with you, you know, he's not that smart. But what I think is actually happening is that he's a populist, and he's saying things that he thinks Americans who would vote for him might actually understand, you know, that might actually mentally register in some way. So 100% tariff sounds really terrifying, right? And it makes him sound important and powerful. But what does it actually mean? It means absolutely nothing. And the other thing to keep in mind is that this is being said in the course of a US presidential campaign. One thing they can be absolutely sure about is promises made in the course of a US presidential campaign mean absolutely nothing. It's called lying as if you're running for office.
We have two things in the United States. One, once again, they're talking about Russia interfering in the process, in the election in the United States. And the other thing is that they're talking about Iran tries to assassinate Donald Trump. And it seems that in their mind, Iran and Russia would benefit from any sort of manipulation in the process of this election, 2024 presidential election in the United States. When you look at these two countries, Iran and Russia, which they tried to talk with the West, Iran in the Middle East and Russia for the case of Ukraine, both of these talks have failed as far as we can say so far. And what would be the benefit for these two countries to interfere in the process of this new presidential election in the United States?
Well, I think that it's pointless from the point of view of Russia. I don't know about Iran. You know, the Persians are wily and have several thousand years worth of imperial history. And they're sort of imponderable as far as their mindsets. But as far as Russians are concerned, the Russians will be happy with whatever outcome, because it'll the whole fight, as it has occurred so far, has weakened the United States. And will continue to weaken the United States. I could dream what the perfect outcome would be of this upcoming election as far as Russia is concerned. And here we would take a page out of late Roman history, where there were several Caesars at the same time. So Kamala would get elected and would be would become the wicked witch of the North. And Trump would get elected and would become the wizard of the South, and they would start wars against each other. So that wouldn't really be so bad if half the country refused to accept the election results favoring the leader they don't like. So I'm just making up a fairy tale here. It really doesn't matter who the president of the United States is at this point, because the United States is heading in a certain direction. And there's going to be an inflection point where the entire revenue of the federal government equals the entire federal outlay to pay interest on the federal debt. That is the tipping point to watch for. It's not too far off. We've reached the tipping point already where payments on the federal debt exceed spending on defense. That has happened this year. nobody, no force in Washington can talk about the necessary austerity and the cuts in spending, including defense and social spending. There's nobody in Washington who can actually wrestle the finances of the country under control. And considering the fact that everybody's running away from the dollar, the situation could grow worse very, very suddenly. So who is president at that point? Well, you know, Donald Trump will say things that will make him feel good. And Kamala Harris will just laugh a lot and wave her hands in the air. But what's the difference? You know, there, I don't think that there's much of a difference.
Yeah. Considering the conflict in Ukraine, Zaluzhny is talking about that if it is necessary to call up women to save Europe from war, we will definitely do it. And do they really think that the Europeans would buy these type of arguments? Because it doesn't seem that Russia would attack Europe, would have in the future right now. And they don't need to do that. And Europeans know this. And why is he trying to do this right now, Zaluzhny, and arguing this type of attitude?
I have absolutely no idea. They've already called up women to an extent. They prefer men. But the times that they actually sent women into combat, into the front line, I actually watched the audio and video of those interactions from the Russian side. So all of these women are, you know, they roll into the line of contact on an armored personnel carrier, which unloads all these women, and they sort of all stand around. They don't know what to do. What you hear on the radio on the Russian side is a lot of laughing and a lot of jokes. So, because they see it from the drones circling overhead. Look, there are all these ladies standing around, and then those ladies start firing at where they think the Russians are, and then the Russians have no choice but to fire back, which they do using artillery, as the Russians. They don't really engage in you know, close quarters combat until they absolutely have to. And so they blow up some of those women, and the rest of the women hide like cats under the carrier that delivered them there, the APC. And eventually all of them get killed. So that's the sort of thing that you would expect to see happening over and over again. And if they recruit women and send them into the front lines, it's not going to change the picture at all. I think that perhaps Zaluzhny is trying to communicate the point that there are no men left, but he can't say we have no men left. Instead, what he says is, let's recruit women. But I don't think it's going to change the picture at all.
Yeah. Let's talk about your new book here. And came out, it's available on Amazon. And could you elaborate on this book and what are you trying to say in this book?
Well, it's Uncontrolled Chaos is the title of the introductory essay, but the rest of it is essays that I've written over the past year. I come out with a new book of essays once a year, around this time of year, giving people a chance to buy copies to give as presents to Christmas presents or New Year's presents to their friends. And people who are not subscribers to my blog, and I know that, you know, these videos are watched by something like 50,000 people, and many fewer than that subscribe to my blog. Well, this is their chance to actually learn what I think about a great many things that that are all in the essays that I write. There isn't really time in a podcast to even touch on most of these subjects. So I want people to buy this book from Amazon. It's available in the U.S. I don't know about all the other marketplaces. It eventually will filter out, excuse me, to other marketplaces. There's also an electronic version if you are in one of those countries that Amazon does not serve. Excuse me. So I would encourage you to get a copy. The electronic copy is available on my blog, which is boosty.to/clubOrlov. And please buy a copy.
And which is in the description. The link is in the description of this video. And that's... To finalize, Dmitry, this talk, and to wrap it up, in your opinion, the way that the United States is trying, that we know that whoever wins the 2024 presidential election in the United States, their main focus is going to be on China. And it seems that they're trying to do their best to separate Iran from Russia, Russia from China, Russia from Iran, and these countries, just separating from each other, these countries. Is that going to be successful, in your opinion, with the attitude that the United States is experiencing right now?
No. That's basically a one-word answer. A slightly more extended answer is... suppose you walk into a playground where all the kids are playing wonderfully with each other, and you decide to tell everyone that you would like everybody to fight each other. What are they going to do to you? They'll look at you like you're an idiot. So that's basically the position that the United States has put itself in. Not even a bully, just kind of like an interloper who shows up and says, I would like to see all of you fight. Well, what's the reaction going to be? Except, go home, idiot.
Before wrapping up, how about Serbia? Right now they're talking about they want to be part of BRICS. Is the United States, together with Europeans, are they going to let them to be part of BRICS? Or are they going to make it so difficult for them to go after this type of mindset?
Well, a lot of it depends on who controls the Danube. And that depends on how well Russia does in the south, in Nikolaev and Odessa and Transnistria. Once Russia controls Transnistria, it controls the Danube, and it has water transportation to Serbia. And that has been, for centuries, the traditional way for Russia and Serbia to economically merge. Once Russia and Serbia manage to economically merge and cooperate, all kinds of possibilities become open for Serbia. It is no longer surrounded by hostile nations at that point. So we'll have to see what the geopolitical developments are in the longer term as the European Union expires, and as various countries in the East go their separate way. And as a lot of them realize that their future lies in cooperating with Russia, as opposed to doing Washington's bidding and being Russia's enemy. So we'll see what happens. But the fact that Serbia wants to be friends with Russia is not by any means, by any stretch of the imagination, newsworthy. It's they've always wanted to be with Russia.
Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.